Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story, an epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 9, The Great Season of Richard the Lionheart. Conrad of Montferrat, the hero of Tyre, is not widely admired by historians of our day, given that he consistently refused to support Richard, even working on a separate deal with Saladin behind Richard's back. But in his own time, he was widely considered a hero, built along the lines of Richard Lionheart himself. Even the Muslims were said to be in awe of him. Nikitos Koniates, the Byzantine chronicler who had seen Eleanor on the streets of Constantinople 40 years before, described Conrad as beautiful in appearance and peerless in his courage. There were campfire stories that he was so brave, he'd once gone into battle with no armor at all, nothing but a linen tunic covering his manly shoulders. It was even boasted by Conrad's many avid supporters that Saladin held Conrad's father captive during the battle for Tyre and threatened to kill him if the city wasn't surrendered, while Conrad coolly replied that his father was an old man who had lived quite long enough, and that he, Conrad, would shoot a crossbow bolt into his father's chest himself if need be. He was already well known to the citizens of Jerusalem, given that his older brother had been Queen Sibylla's first husband. Richard and Philip had chosen him to negotiate the acre ransom, and he'd certainly made a good job of it. On top of all that, he possessed blood ties to Philip and to Germany's lamented hero Frederick Barbarossa. Given his platinum-plated background, Conrad was wildly popular, especially among the French. Still, his rival Guy of Lusignan, if greatly diminished in stature, wasn't entirely out of the running. For one thing, there were people who admired his audacity at Acre. And oddly enough, Guy was Richard's choice to be king, which gave him additional momentum. One might think no Plantagenet would bother to advance the Lusignan family, but the Lusignans were Aquitanian vassals, no matter how dubious their loyalty. Adding to his favor with Lionheart, Guy had dutifully hurried to Cyprus to lend his active support to Richard's campaign to rid the place of Isaac Comnenus. In short, the ties between Guy and Richard might be thin, but they did exist, and they were buoyed by what some considered the attractive prospect of powerful Plantagenet dominance over one of the supreme cities in Christendom. With Richard's backing and at least some popular support, Guy simply refused to step aside. After all, if he himself had only a tenuous claim to Jerusalem's throne based largely on a dead woman's love, Conrad had no real claim at all. Unfortunately, Guy failed to take into account the enthusiasm much of the populace felt for his rival. If Conrad had no right to Jerusalem's throne, his ardent supporters decided they'd invent it. Among the thousands living at Acre Camp was a lady named Isabella, yet another reputed beauty, who happened to be the younger half-sister to lamented Baldwin and Sibylla. In the wake of her sibling's death, no direct heirs left, she held the best hereditary claim to the throne. Lovely Isabella was already married to a crusader lord, a gentleman named Humphrey of Toron. No matter. According to legend, the flustered Isabella was pulled from her husband's tent and bullied by her mother into agreeing to an annulment followed by a new marriage to glorious Conrad. While romantic, it's only half true. No one was pulled from any tents, as far as historians can tell. But her marriage to Humphrey was annulled, on the grounds that she'd been too young to marry. That fact had certainly been known to one and all at the time, and had never been raised before. But so be it. There was equal public indifference to the fact that Conrad and Isabella had once been in-laws. Her sister Sibylla's first husband, duly deceased, was Conrad's brother. Under church law at the time, a marriage between these former relatives constituted incest. No one cared. Nor was much said about Conrad's two prior wives, from whom he may or may not have been properly annulled. Recognizing Conrad's popularity, especially with the restive French, Richard finally sat down with Philip Augustus to carve up the Kingdom of Jerusalem, even though they had no actual control over it. The two kings came to a compromise. Guy was promised the south, while Conrad was granted control over Tyre and the north. The kingdom would be reunited upon Guy's eventual death, when Conrad and his heirs would inherit it all. This thorny political problem supposedly solved, at least on paper, Lionheart could turn his attention back to the far more satisfying activity of making war. The August 1191 campaign season would soon end, and Richard needed to move toward Jerusalem before too many more weeks slipped past. He therefore grew increasingly irritated at Saladin's delay in delivering the immense Acre ransom, 414,000 pieces of Muslim gold. Richard had grown up under Western military rules, where sieges, if awful in their own right, thankfully tended to avoid wholesale slaughter. Defenders usually saw the handwriting on the wall and surrendered, after which they'd punctiliously hold to the terms of their capitulation, including prompt payment of ransom. In Richard's world, if ransom needed to be paid, people saw to it that the thing was done. But Acre wasn't following this well-established European script. The garrison's ransom had been promised within a month of Acre's fall, and the August 12th deadline was fast approaching. Yet days ticked by without the welcome arrival of sacks bulging with gold. Part of the delay was the sheer difficulty Saladin faced in trying to raise such a fortune from the morose Muslim community which had just lost one of its wealthiest cities. Then, too, Saladin was in no hurry to free Richard from his forced occupation of Acre, which kept this masterful opponent pinned to a known location. Muslim delegates kept arriving to argue politely for more time, altered terms, different hostages. Days passed. The ransom gold did not make its way to Acre. On August 20th, the last and final day permitted to settle the massive debt, with no payment made, Richard's response to Saracen foot-dragging was incandescent. Lionheart had Acre's captives, which he himself said numbered almost 3,000 human beings, forcibly marched outside the walls and executed. A bloodbath that horrified Arab witnesses who tried to mount a hopeless rescue. Killing the hostages was no simple matter of standing back and firing. Each victim had to be killed particularly and individually by men wielding spears and metal blades that must have dulled as they repeatedly rose and fell. It was an ugly day's work, particularly since there is some evidence that Richard had initially agreed that even if the huge ransom was never paid, the worst outcome for the hostages would be slavery, certainly not death. Saladin would retaliate by killing some European captives of his own, but the ruthless slaughter seems to have quickly fogged over, both at home and in the Muslim world. Few in Europe, including the Pope, lost sleep over the deaths of a few thousand infidels, although one or two isolated critics thought Richard barbarous. For his part, Richard calmly wrote the Abbot of Clairvaux that the carnage had been Saladin's fault, since Saladin had forced his hand, leaving him with all those unransomed hostages when he needed to head toward Jerusalem. It's possible, as historian Frank McLinn maintains, that Saladin decided to sacrifice a few thousand foot soldiers to save a literal fortune in ransom gold. Perhaps Saladin even hoped that letting such brutality play out would reinvigorate his countrymen, devastated by the loss of Acre. Crusade historian Thomas Asbridge, generally fond of Lionheart, shrugs off the bloody afternoon as an act of military expediency. Richard could not conceivably move on Jerusalem with thousands of unwilling hostages stumbling along with his army. The Acre massacre put the entire Muslim world on notice not to trifle with Richard, while it pruned European responsibilities towards several thousand mouths that otherwise would have to be fed through the coming winter. With the Acre saga finally at an end, Richard the Lionheart, hero of Messina, of Cyprus, of Acre, scourge of Saladin, threw himself into expanding upon his prodigious achievements. His greatest season, while destined to be brief, had arrived. Richard and Saladin both understood there were two potential targets for Richard's army as it prepared to march from Acre into the Arab-held south. One option was to head inland to the east and then south to Jerusalem, the sworn goal of this entire crusade, a march of some 150 miles through hostile desert, dragging siege equipment and baggage. Alternatively, 80 miles due south of Acre along the better coast road, where his right flank would be protected by the Mediterranean, lay the Muslim-held port of Jaffa, a coastal city only 50 miles west of Jerusalem. Once in Jaffa, Richard could readily make that 50-mile left turn toward the Holy City. He might even use Jaffa as a base to go further south, past Jerusalem, potentially grabbing Ascalon, the Muslim port that anchored Saladin's supply lines to Egypt, the crown jewel of the Arab commercial world. Trying to gauge each other's intentions, strengths, and weaknesses, they both relied on spies, locals who did the odd jobs in the camps and were happy to talk about what they had seen and heard for the right payoff. Both were also willing to coax information, with varying degrees of compassion, from captives. The word seemed to be that the port of Ascalon was Richard's ultimate goal. Holding it meant he could hamstring Saladin by depriving him of his best remaining Mediterranean port, and then still strike either east toward Jerusalem or south toward Egypt. Saladin was so convinced of it, he had Ascalon's walls torn down to keep them out of Crusaders' hands. From everything we can glean, Ascalon in fact was the prize Richard most wanted. But even the historians can't entirely agree on what he was doing, or why he did it, in the year between the autumn of 1191 and October 1192. He faced a true dilemma. Ascalon might make all the strategic sense in the world, but an Ascalon campaign would never work. Richard wasn't leading a secular army, but a religious crusade that cared about victory only to the extent it triumphed in Jerusalem. And even at that, he commanded a coalition of Plantagenet, French, and German troops, with no one but the Plantagenet forces owing fealty to him. All of these men had already spent a year or more of their lives living with danger, hardship, and death so they could rescue Jerusalem. There was a limit to how long their commander could deny them, and Richard would struggle for months trying to reconcile what he wanted with what he had to do, taking up one plan only to abandon it for another. He had to get moving, and he chose to go south along the coast. It wasn't a simple undertaking. No matter how his crusaders might long for the opportunity to fight for God, Richard reportedly had to kick, bribe, cajole, and scream to get his men to exchange the relaxed pleasures of Acre for the risks of a march back into Muslim territory. It took him days to get his 16,000 infantrymen and several thousand knights moving, half of them probably trying to sober up while they searched for their breastplates, the lucky ones wreathing their heads with wild celery leaves to dull the murderous roar of monumental hangovers. Richard knew what they were up against: daytime heat, nighttime cold, danger every mile of the route, and at the end of it all, they would face another god-awful siege somewhere. To his credit, his command of the march had been praised by military historians ever since as an example of the brilliant, charismatic leadership that seems to have been the very breath of life to Richard Lionheart. He had learned from the debacle at Hattin that failure to care for an army as it marched across a desert would bring disaster. He accordingly saw to it that every march was followed by a day or two of rest in camp. This innovative schedule also may have kept the Saracens off kilter, not sure how much ground he'd cover in any given day, therefore unsure where best to plan an attack. He also carefully shepherded tons upon tons upon tons of supplies. One avid historian has calculated Lionheart's army needed 800,000 gallons of water, not necessarily all available in local wells, especially as Richard expected the Muslims to poison them. Given that 800,000 gallons of water would weigh a staggering 6.7 million pounds, Lionheart took advantage of the sea and the European fleet to haul all that weight, the crusaders hugging the coastline so closely that men on the right flank waited in the Mediterranean. Constant support was provided by Lionheart's navy, shadowing him just offshore, using little dinghies to ferry supplies and new arrivals in, sick and wounded men out. Richard's ocean of tax money even reduced the number of wounded men. The Muslims were transfixed by the quality of the crusaders' full-body chainmail, so beautifully made that arrows could barely penetrate it. One Arab described Europeans with 10 arrows fixed in their backs, marching along as if they had not a care in the world. Throughout the two-week march south, Richard was a constant presence, buoying morale, solving problems, calming casualties as they waited to be ferried to the big transports that rode the winds off the coast. It was Lionheart at his best, tireless, confident, innovative, attentive to his men. Yet no matter how well thought out and executed, the 80-mile march from Acre exposed the crusaders in their handsome armor to the Syrian desert in August. Even with pre-dawn starts to avoid the worst of the dreaded heat, almost every mile saw men drop from exhaustion. Some died of it. Others were killed during constant run-ins with the shadowing Muslims, one little clash lasting long enough for an infantryman known as Evrart to have his hand slashed off, after which an admiring observer reported that the remarkably stoic Everard paid no attention to this and made no complaint. Tarantulas, fleas, sand, and scorpions plagued men and horses. Fresh water was at a premium. Soldiers scared themselves listening to campfire stories of deadly snakes that could fly, and crocodiles that lusted specifically for crustacean flesh. Food got scarcer as the days ground on. Things reached a point where horses that died along the way were automatically butchered and eaten, ravenous soldiers chewing through tough, crudely cooked horse meat. Some 10 days south of Acre, still well short of Jaffa at their rate of march, the Crusaders were attacked by Saladin's army, led by Saladin himself. There was a brisk fight near the Dead River. It turned into another bad day for the Muslims. One of their most spectacular warriors, El Tawil, admired as a genuine hero by Muslims and Crusaders alike, was unhorsed and died under a smothering cloud of European infantry. Richard, wearing armor, took either a lance or a crossbow bolt in the side while on horseback. The hardiness of the men of his day prevailed. He didn't even let himself get knocked out of the saddle. He kept shepherding his army south. Saladin, frustrated at the Dead River, decided to try drawing a line around the little town called Arsuf a bit further down the road. It rested on sandstone cliffs behind a low screen of hills and, like a miniature Damascus, was nestled amid trees planted as much as 12 miles deep. Thoughts of the place rather frightened the Europeans, who feared ambush and feared even more that the Muslims would set fire to the forests. Both parties, uneasy, made a stab at negotiating a truce, but negotiations failed almost as soon as they started. It was early September 1191. If Saladin couldn't stop the Crusaders here, they couldn't be stopped anywhere. This was going to be his ultimate effort to push the European invaders out. Richard's command on that September day gave rise to a French poem, famed in its time, called The Crusade of Richard Lionheart, in which heroic Richard chooses to confront his Muslim rival in glorious open combat. In reality, it's probably more likely that Richard wanted to do whatever he could to avoid a pitched battle, preferring to guarantee the odds of his army making it to Jaffa in one piece. Whatever his intentions, as the sun came up on the morning of September 7th, 1191, some 18,000 Crusaders woke to the sight of 25,000 Muslim fighters arrayed in seemingly infinite ranks across the low hills ahead, thousands of them mounted archers. Some Crusaders would even find themselves gaping at the most frightening men they had ever seen, men they never would have imagined. Men said to be blacker than soot, summoned from Africa to Saladin's flag. One eyewitness described the Europeans as surrounded like a flock of sheep in the jaws of wolves. The Crusaders, with their backs to the sea, had to feel it in their very souls. Saracen trumpeters and drummers, Arab horses restlessly shifting as the rising sun began to warm the air, the scent of men bracing themselves for the shock of contact, a languid desert breeze rustling Arsuf's trees, the magnified clicking sound of thousands of arrows being fitted into bowstrings. For one timeless day, more than 40,000 men struggled together under the relentless sun. The Crusaders put their heads down, raised their shields, and set off in line of march to reach Arsuf on the other side of the forests. No one who survived would ever forget it. Lionheart's ability to hold his men in formation under indescribable pressure saved them. They trusted Richard. They had learned discipline. They knew how to hold a line, and they held it, even if they died doing so. They held it in temperatures that must have been well over 100 degrees under their stifling, bloodied canopy of shields. They held it with arrows in their feet and arms. They held it as their invaluable warhorses died from dehydration, died from spear points tearing their lungs. They held it hour after crawling hour. To keep his shield wall intact, Richard absolutely outlawed any counterattack that would break ranks. The fierce Knights Hospitallers, who had the rear guard and therefore had to move backwards hour after interminable hour, were refused permission to lash at their tormentors, despite their stormy protests that they were violently pressed, losing their irreplaceable horses and infuriated by their forced passivity. The advance guard reached Arsuf in the early afternoon. Richard's worries might have ebbed just a little, everything having gone better than he had a right to expect, when everyone heard the unmistakable sound of a mounted charge half a mile away. Two of his Hospitaller commanders had finally cracked under the strain and headed full tilt into the Muslim ranks, followed within seconds by every man who saw them go. Entire units of Richard's army surging out of their controlled defensive line to take on the maddening enemy. However shocked he must have been in that first instant, Richard was said to ride faster than a bolt from a crossbow to join the boiling attack. What should have been a Christian disaster turned on its head. Muslims suddenly fleeing crusaders turned into madmen under the unimaginable pressure of that day. The Saracens collapsed under the attack's intensity. Some chroniclers said that 30 of Saladin's chiefs, along with as many as 7,000 of his infantrymen, were killed. There are reports that it took 20 wagons to haul off the weapons left littering the battlefield. Saracen corpses were stripped and rifled. These nomadic warriors carried their personal fortunes with them, and they now gave up their gold as they had given their lives. And so Richard Lionheart won yet again, against amazing odds, against everything the Muslim world could throw against him. It was indeed his greatest season. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author, Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction, and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again, January 13th, for the next episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.